hotel bedroom. "You haven't started a cold, have you?" she said at breakfast. "No," I told her. I don't think so," clutching at a straw, for this might serve as an excuse later if I was over pink about the eyes. "I hate hanging about once everything is packed," she grumbled. "We ought to have decided on the earlier train. We could get it if we made the effort and then have longer in Paris. Wire Helen not to meet us, but arrange another rendezvous. I wonder," she glanced at her watch, "I suppose they could change the reservations. Anyway, it's worth trying. Go down to the office and see." "Yes," I said, a dummy to her moods, going into my bedroom and flinging off my dressing gown, fastening my inevitable flannel skirt, and stretching my homemade jumper over my head. My indifference to her turned to hatred. This was the end. Even my morning must be taken from me. No last half hour on the terrace, not even 10 minutes, perhaps, to say goodbye. Because she had finished breakfast earlier than she expected, because she was bored. Well, then, I would fling away restraint and modesty. I would not be proud any more. I slammed the door of the sitting room and ran along the passage. I did not wait for the lift. I climbed the stairs, 3 at a time, up to the 3rd floor. I knew the number of his room, 148. And I hammered at the door, very flushed in the face and breathless. "Come in," he shouted, and I opened the door, repenting already, my nerve failing me, for perhaps he had only just woken up, having been late last night, and would be still in bed, tousled in the head and irritable. He was shaving by the open window, a camel-hair jacket over his pyjamas, and I, in my flannel suit and heavy shoes, felt clumsy and overdressed. I was merely foolish when I had felt myself dramatic. "What do you want?" he said. "Is something the matter?"
"I've come to say goodbye," I said. "We're going this morning." He stared at me, then put his razor down on the washstand.
"Shut the door," he said.
I closed it behind me and stood there, rather self-conscious, my hands hanging by my side.
"What on earth are you talking about?" he asked.
"It's true. We're leaving today. We were going by the later train, and now she wants to catch the earlier one, and I was afraid I shouldn't see you again. I felt I must see you before I left to thank you." They tumbled out, the idiotic words, just as I had imagined them. I was stiff and awkward. In a moment, I should say, he had been ripping.
"Why didn't you tell me about this before?" he said.
"She only decided yesterday. It was all done in a hurry. Her daughter sails for New York on Saturday, and we're going with her. We're joining her in Paris and going through to Cherbourg."
"She's taking you with her to New York?"
"Yes, and I don't want to go. I shall hate it. I shall be miserable."
"Why in heaven's name go with her, then?"
"I have to. You know that. I work for a salary. I can't afford to leave her." He picked up his razor again and took the soap off his face.
"Sit down," he said. "I shan't be long. I'll dress in the bathroom and be ready in 5 minutes."
He took his clothes off the chair and threw them on the bathroom floor and went inside, slamming the door. I sat down on the bed and began biting my nails. The situation was unreal, and I felt like a lay figure. I wondered what he was thinking, what he was going to do. I glanced round the room. It was the room of any man, untidy and impersonal. Lots of shoes, more than ever were needed, and strings of ties. The dressing table was bare, except for a large bottle of hair wash and a pair of ivory hairbrushes. No photographs, no snapshots, nothing like that. Instinctively, I had looked for them, thinking there would be one photograph at least beside his bed, or in the middle of the mantelpiece, one large one in a leather frame. There were only books, though, and a box of cigarettes. He was ready, as he had promised, in 5 minutes.
"Come down to the terrace while I eat my breakfast," he said.
I looked at my watch. "I haven't time," I told him. "I ought to be in the office now, changing the reservations."
"Never mind about that. I've got to talk to you," he said.
We walked down the corridor, and he rang for the lift. He can't realize, I thought, that the early train leaves in about an hour and a half. Mrs. Van Hopper will ring up the office in a moment and ask if I'm there. We went down in the lift, not talking, and so out to the terrace where the tables were laid for breakfast.
"What are you going to have?" he said.
"I've had mine already," I told him, "and I can only stay 4 minutes anyway."
"Bring me coffee, a boiled egg, toast, marmalade, and a tangerine," he said to the waiter.
And he took an emery board out of his pocket and began filing his nails. So Mrs. Van Hopper has had enough of Monte Carlo, he said, and now she wants to go home. So do I. She to New York, and I to Manderley. Which would you prefer? You can take your choice.
Don't make a joke about it. It's unfair, I said. And I think I had better see about those tickets and say goodbye now.
If you think I'm one of those people who try to be funny at breakfast, you're wrong, he said. I'm invariably ill-tempered in the early morning. I repeat to you, the choice is open to you. Either you go to America with Mrs. Van Hopper, or you come home to Manderley with me.
Do you mean you want a secretary or something?
No, I'm asking you to marry me, you little fool.
The waiter came with the breakfast, and I sat with my hands in my lap, watching while he put down the pot of coffee and the jug of milk. You don't understand, I said, when the waiter had gone. I'm not the sort of person men marry.
What the devil do you mean, he said, staring at me, laying down his spoon.
I watched a fly settle on the marmalade, and he brushed it away impatiently. I'm not sure, I said slowly. I don't think I know how to explain. I don't belong to your sort of world, for one thing.
What is my world?
Well, Manderley. You know what I mean. He picked up his spoon again and helped himself to marmalade.
You are almost as ignorant as Mrs. Van Hopper, and just as unintelligent. What do you know of Manderley? I'm the person to judge that, whether you would belong there or not. You think I ask you this on the spur of the moment, don't you? Because you say you don't want to go to New York. You think I ask you to marry me, for the same reason you believed I drove you about in the car, yes, and gave you dinner that first evening. To be kind, don't you?
Yes, I said.
One day, he went on, spreading his toast thick, you may realize that philanthropy is not my strongest quality. At the moment, I don't think you realize anything at all.
You haven't answered my question.
Are you going to marry me?
I don't believe, even in my fiercest moments, I had considered this possibility. I had once, when driving with him, and we had been silent for many miles, started a rambling story in my head about him being very ill, delirious, I think, and sending for me, and I having to nurse him. I had reached the point in my story where I was putting eau de cologne on his head when we arrived at the hotel, and so it finished there. And another time I had imagined living in a lodge in the grounds of Manderley, and how he would visit me sometimes and sit in front of the fire. This sudden talk of marriage bewildered me, even shocked me, I think. It was as though the king asked one. It did not ring true. And he went on eating his marmalade as though everything were natural. In books, men knelt to women, and it would be moonlight. Not at breakfast. Not like this.
My suggestion doesn't seem to have gone too well, he said. I'm sorry. I rather thought you loved me. A fine blow to my conceit.
I do love you, I said. I love you dreadfully. You've made me very unhappy, and I've been crying all night because I thought I should never see you again. When I said this, I remember he laughed and stretched his hand to me across the breakfast table.
Bless you for that, he said. One day, when you reach that exalted age of 36, which you told me was your ambition, I'll remind you of this moment, and you won't believe me. It's a pity you have to grow up.
I was ashamed already, and angry with him for laughing. So women did not make those confessions to men. I had a lot to learn.
So that's settled, isn't it, he said, going on with his toast and marmalade. Instead of being companion to Mrs. Van Hopper, you become mine, and your duties will be almost exactly the same. I also like new library books and flowers in the drawing room and bezique after dinner and someone to pour out my tea. The only difference is that I don't take Taxol. I prefer Eno's, and you must never let me run out of my particular brand of toothpaste.
I drummed with my fingers on the table, uncertain of myself and of him. Was he still laughing at me? Was it all a joke?
He looked up and saw the anxiety on my face. "I'm being rather a brute to you, aren't I?" he said. "This isn't your idea of a proposal. We ought to be in a conservatory, you in a white frock with a rose in your hand and a violin playing a waltz in the distance, and I should make violent love to you behind a palm tree. You would feel then that you were getting your money's worth. Poor darling, what a shame. Never mind, I'll take you to Venice for our honeymoon, and we'll hold hands in the gondola. But we won't stay too long, because I want to show you Mandalay.
He wanted to show me Mandalay. And suddenly I realized that it would all happen. I would be his wife. We would walk in the garden together, we would stroll down that path in the valley to the shingle beach. I knew how I would stand on the steps after breakfast, looking at the day, throwing crumbs to the birds, and later wander out in a shady hat with long scissors in my hand, and cut flowers for the house. I knew now why I had bought that picture postcard as a child. It was a premonition, a blank step into the future. He wanted to show me Mandalay. My mind ran riot then. Figures came before me, and picture after picture, and all the while he ate his tangerine, giving me a piece now and then and watching me. We would be in a crowd of people, and he would say, "I don't think you've met my wife, Mrs. De Winter." I would be Mrs. De Winter. I considered my name and the signature on checks to tradesmen, and in letters asking people to dinner. I heard myself talking on the telephone, "Why not come down to Mandalay next weekend?" People, always a throng of people. "Oh, but she's simply charming. You must meet her." This about me, a whisper on the fringe of a crowd, and I would turn away, pretending I had not heard. Going down to the lodge with a basket on my arm, grapes and peaches for the old lady who was sick, her hand stretched out to me, "The Lord bless you, madam, for being so good," and my saying, "Just send up to the house for anything you want." Mrs. De Winter. I would be Mrs. De Winter. I saw the polished table in the dining room and the long candles. Maxim sitting at the end. A party of 24. I had a flower in my hair. Everyone looked towards me, holding up his glass. "We must drink the health of the bride." And Maxim saying afterwards, "I have never seen you look so lovely." Great, cool rooms filled with flowers. My bedroom with a fire in the winter, someone knocking at the door, and a woman comes in smiling. She is Maxim's sister, and she is saying, "It's really wonderful how happy you have made him. Everyone is so pleased. You are such a success." Mrs. De Winter. I would be Mrs. De Winter.
"The rest of the tangerine is sour. I shouldn't eat it," he said. And I stared at him, the words going slowly to my head, then looked down at the fruit on my plate. The quarter was hard and pale. He was right. The tangerine was very sour. I had a sharp, bitter taste in my mouth, and I had only just noticed it. "Am I going to break the news to Mrs. Van Hopper, or are you?" he said. He was folding up his napkin, pushing back his plate, and I wondered how it was he spoke so casually, as though the matter was of little consequence, a mere adjustment of plans. Whereas to me, it was a bombshell exploding in a thousand fragments. "You tell her," I said. "She'll be so angry." We got up from the table, I excited and flushed, trembling already in anticipation. I wondered if he would tell the waiter, take my arm smilingly and say, "You must congratulate us. Mademoiselle and I are going to be married." And all the other waiters would hear, would bow to us, would smile, and we would pass into the lounge, a wave of excitement following us, a flutter of expectation. But he said nothing. He left the terrace without a word, and I followed him to the lift. We passed the reception desk, and no one even looked at us. The clerk was busy with a sheaf of papers. He was talking over his shoulder to his junior. "He does not know," I thought, "that I am going to be Mrs. De Winter. I am going to live at Mandalay. Mandalay will belong to me." We went up in the lift to the first floor and so along the passage. He took my hand and swung it as we went along. "Does 42 seem very old to you?" he said. "Oh, no," I told him, quickly, too eagerly, perhaps. "I don't like young men." "You've never known any," he said. We came to the door of the suite. "I think I had better deal with this alone," he said. "Tell me something. Do you mind how soon you marry me?
You don't want a trousseau, do you, or any of that nonsense, because the whole thing can be so easily arranged in a few days, over a desk with a license and then off in the car to Venice or anywhere you fancy.
Not in a church, I asked. Not in white, with bridesmaids and bells and choir boys. What about your relations and all your friends?
You forget, he said. I had that sort of wedding before.
We went on standing in front of the door of the suite, and I noticed that the daily paper was still thrust through the letterbox. We had been too busy to read it at breakfast.
Well, he said, what about it?
Of course, I answered. I was thinking for the moment we would be married at home. Naturally, I don't expect a church or people or anything like that. And I smiled at him. I made a cheerful face. Won't it be fun? I said. He had turned to the door, though, and opened it, and we were inside the suite in the little entrance passage.
"Is that you?" called Mrs. Van Hopper from the sitting-room. "What in the name of Mike have you been doing? I've rung the office 3 times, and they said they hadn't seen you."
I was seized with a sudden desire to laugh, to cry, to do both, and I had a pain, too, at the pit of my stomach. I wished, for one wild moment, that none of this had happened, that I was alone somewhere, going for a walk, and whistling.
"I'm afraid it's all my fault," he said, going into the sitting-room, shutting the door behind him,
and I heard her exclamation of surprise. Then I went into my bedroom and sat down by the open window. It was like waiting in the anteroom at a doctor's. I ought to turn over the pages of a magazine, look at photographs that did not matter, and read articles I should never remember, until the nurse came, bright and efficient, all humanity washed away by years of disinfectant. "It's all right. The operation was quite successful. There is no need to worry at all. I should go home and have some sleep." The walls of the suite were thick. I could hear no hum of voices. I wondered what he was saying to her, how he phrased his words. Perhaps he said,
"I fell in love with her, you know, the very first time we met. We've been seeing one another every day."
And she, in answer,
"Why, Mr. de Winter, it's quite the most romantic thing I've ever heard."
Romantic. That was the word I had tried to remember coming up in the lift. Yes, of course. Romantic. That was what people would say. It was all very sudden and romantic. They suddenly decided to get married, and there it was, such an adventure. I smiled to myself as I hugged my knees on the window seat, thinking how wonderful it was, how happy I was going to be. I was to marry the man I loved. I was to be Mrs. de Winter. It was foolish to go on having that pain in the pit of my stomach when I was so happy. Oh, nerves, of course, waiting like this, the doctor's anteroom. It would have been better after all, more natural, surely, to have gone into the sitting-room hand in hand, laughing, smiling at one another, and for him to say, "We're going to be married, we're very much in love."
In love. He had not said anything yet about being in love. No time, perhaps. It was all so hurried at the breakfast table. Marmalade and coffee and that tangerine. No time. The tangerine was very bitter. No, he had not said anything about being in love, just that we would be married. Short and definite, very original. Original proposals were much better, more genuine, not like other people, not like younger men who talked nonsense probably, not meaning half they said, not like younger men being very incoherent, very passionate, swearing impossibilities, not like him the first time, asking Rebecca. I must not think of that. Put it away. A thought forbidden. Prompted by demons. Get thee behind me, Satan. I must never think about that. Never, never, never. He loves me. He wants to show me Manderley. Would they ever have done with their talking? Would they ever call me into the room? There was the book of poems lying beside my bed. He had forgotten he had ever lent them to me. They could not mean much to him then.
"Go on," whispered the demon. "Open the title page. That's what you want to do, isn't it? Open the title page."
"Nonsense," I said. "I'm only going to put the book with the rest of the things." I yawned.
I wandered to the table beside the bed. I picked up the book. I caught my foot in the flex of the bedside lamp and stumbled, the book falling from my hands onto the floor. It fell open at the title page. Max from Rebecca. She was dead, and one must not have thoughts about the dead. They slept in peace. The grass blew over their graves. How alive was her writing, though, how full of force, those curious sloping letters. The blob of ink, done yesterday, was just as if it had been written yesterday. I took my nail scissors from the dressing case and cut the page, looking over my shoulder like a criminal. I cut the page right out of the book. I left no jagged edges, and the book looked white and clean when the page was gone. A new book that had not been touched. I tore the page up in many little fragments and threw them into the waste paper basket. Then I went and sat on the window seat again. But I kept thinking of the torn scraps in the basket, and after a moment I had to get up and look in the basket once more. Even now the ink stood up on the fragments, thick and black. The writing was not destroyed. I took a box of matches and set fire to the fragments. The flame had a lovely light, staining the paper, curling the edges, making the slanting writing impossible to distinguish. The fragments fluttered to grey ashes. The letter R was the last to go. It twisted in the flame. It curled outwards for a moment, becoming larger than ever. Then it crumpled too. The flame destroyed it. It was not ashes even. It was feathery dust. I went and washed my hands in the basin. I felt better. Much better. I had the clean new feeling that one has when the calendar is hung on the wall at the beginning of the year. January the 1st. I was aware of the same freshness, the same gay confidence. The door opened and he came into the room.
"All's well," he said. Shock made her speechless at first, but she's beginning to recover, so I'm going downstairs to the office to make certain she will catch the first train. For a moment she wavered. I think she had hopes of acting witness at the wedding, but I was very firm. Go and talk to her.
He said nothing about being glad, about being happy. He did not take my arm and go into the sitting room with me. He smiled and waved his hand and went off down the corridor alone. I went to Mrs. Van Hopper, uncertain, rather self-conscious, like a maid who has handed in her notice through a friend. She was standing by the window smoking a cigarette, an odd, dumpy little figure I should not see again, her coat stretched tight over her large breasts, her ridiculous hat perched sideways on her head.
"Well," she said, her voice dry and hard, not the voice she would have used to him, "I suppose I've got to hand it to you for a double-time worker. Still waters certainly run deep in your case. How did you manage it?"
I did not know what to answer. I did not like her smile.
"Was a lucky thing for you. I had the influenza," she said. "I realize now how you spent your days and why you were so forgetful. Tennis lessons, my eye. You might have told me, you know."
"I'm sorry," I said. She looked at me curiously. She ran her eyes over my figure.
"And he tells me he wants to marry you in a few days. Lucky again for you that you haven't a family to ask questions. Well, it's nothing to do with me anymore. I wash my hands of the whole affair. I rather wonder what his friends will think, but I suppose that's up to him. You realize he's years older than you."
"He's only 42, I said. "And I'm old for my age." She laughed. She dropped cigarette ash on the floor.
"You certainly are," she said.
She went on looking at me in a way she had never done before, appraising me, running her eyes over my points like a judge at a cattle show. There was something inquisitive about her eyes, something unpleasant.
"Tell me," she said, "intimate friend to a friend, have you been doing anything you shouldn't?"
She was like Blaze, the dressmaker, who had offered me that 10%. "I don't know what you mean," I said.
She laughed. She shrugged her shoulders. "Oh, well, never mind. But I always said English girls were dark horses, for all their hockey-playing attitude. So I'm supposed to travel to Paris alone and leave you here while your beau gets a marriage license. I notice he doesn't ask me to the wedding."
"I don't think he wants anyone. And anyway, you would have sailed, I said.
Ha ha, she said.
She took out her vanity case and began powdering her nose.
I suppose you really do know your own mind, she went on. After all, the whole thing has been very hurried, hasn't it? A matter of a few weeks. I don't suppose he's too easy, and you'll have to adapt yourself to his ways. You've led an extremely sheltered life up to now, you know, and you can't say that I've run you off your feet. You will have your work cut out as Mistress of Manderley. To be perfectly frank, my dear, I simply can't see you doing it.
Her words sounded like the echo of my own an hour before.
You haven't the experience, she continued. You don't know that milieu. You can scarcely string two sentences together at my bridge teas. What are you going to say to all his friends? The Manderley parties were famous when she was alive. Of course, he's told you all about them.
I hesitated, but she went on, thank heaven, not waiting for my answer.
Naturally, one wants you to be happy, and I grant you he's a very attractive creature, but, well, I'm sorry, and personally I think you're making a big mistake, one you will bitterly regret.
She put down the box of powder and looked at me over her shoulder. Perhaps she was being sincere at last. But I did not want that sort of honesty. I did not say anything. I looked sullen, perhaps, for she shrugged her shoulders and wandered to the looking-glass, straightening her little mushroom hat. I was glad she was going. Glad I should not see her again. I grudged the months I had spent with her, employed by her, taking her money, trotting in her wake like a shadow, drab and dumb. Of course I was inexperienced. Of course I was idiotic, shy and young. I knew all that. She did not have to tell me. I suppose her attitude was deliberate, and for some odd feminine reason she resented this marriage. Her scale of values had received a shock. Well, I would not care. I would forget her and her barbed words. A new confidence had been born in me when I burnt that page and scattered the fragments. The past would not exist for either of us. We were starting afresh, he and I. The past had blown away like the ashes in the waste paper basket. I was going to be Mrs. De Winter. I was going to live at Manderley. Soon she would be gone, rattling alone in the wagon-lit without me, and he and I would be together in the dining room of the hotel, lunching at the same table, planning the future. The brink of a big adventure. Perhaps, once she had gone, he would talk to me at last, about loving me, about being happy. Up to now there had been no time, and anyway, those things are not easily said. They must wait their moment. I looked up and caught her reflection in the looking-glass. She was watching me, a little tolerant smile on her lips. I thought she was going to be generous after all, hold out her hand and wish me luck, give me encouragement and tell me that everything was going to be all right. But she went on smiling, twisting a stray hair into place beneath her hat.
Of course, she said. You know why he is marrying you, don't you? You haven't flattered yourself he's in love with you. The fact is, that empty house got on his nerves to such an extent he nearly went off his head. He admitted as much before you came into the room. He just can't go on living there alone.
Chapter 7 We came to Manderley in early May, arriving, so Maxim said, with the first swallows and the bluebells. It would be the best moment, before the full flush of summer, and in the valley the azaleas would be prodigal of scent, and the blood-red rhododendrons in bloom. We motored, I remember, leaving London in the morning in a heavy shower of rain, coming to Manderley about 5 o'clock, in time for tea. I can see myself now, unsuitably dressed as usual, although a bride of 7 weeks, in a tan-coloured stockinette frock, a small fur known as a stone martin round my neck, and over all a shapeless mackintosh, far too big for me, and dragging to my ankles. It was, I thought, a gesture to the weather, and the length added inches to my height. I clutched a pair of gauntlet gloves in my hands and carried a large leather handbag. "This is London rain," said Maxim when we left. "You wait. The sun will be shining for you when we come to Manderley." And he was right, for the clouds left us at Exeter, They rolled away behind us, leaving a great blue sky above our heads and a white road in front of us. I was glad to see the sun, for in superstitious fashion I looked upon rain as an omen of ill will, and the leaden skies of London had made me silent. "Feeling better?" said Maxim, and I smiled at him, taking his hand, thinking how easy it was for him, going to his own home, wandering into the hall, picking up letters, ringing a bell for tea, and I wondered how much he guessed of my nervousness, and whether his question, "feeling better," meant that he understood.
"Never mind. We'll soon be there. I expect you want your tea," he said,
and he let go my hand, because we had reached a bend in the road and must slow down. I knew then that he had mistaken my silence for fatigue, and it had not occurred to him I dreaded this arrival at Manderley as much as I had longed for it in theory. Now the moment was upon me, I wished it delayed. I wanted to draw up at some wayside inn and stay there in a coffee-room by an impersonal fire. I wanted to be a traveller on the road, a bride in love with her husband. Not myself, coming to Manderley for the first time, the wife of Maxim de Winter. We passed many friendly villages where the cottage windows had a kindly air. A woman holding a baby in her arms smiled at me from a doorway, while a man clanked across a road to a well, carrying a pail. I wished we could have been one with them, perhaps their neighbours, and that Maxim could lean over a cottage gate in the evening, smoking a pipe, proud of a very tall hollyhock he had grown himself, while I bustled in my kitchen, clean as a pin, laying the table for supper. There would be an alarm clock on the dresser ticking loudly, and a row of shining plates, while after supper Maxim would read his paper, boots on the fender, and I reach for a great pile of mending in the dresser drawer. Surely it would be peaceful and steady, that way of living, and easier too, demanding no set standard.
"Only 2 miles further," said Maxim. "You see that great belt of trees on the brow of the hill there, sloping to the valley, with a scrap of sea beyond? That's Manderley in there. Those are the woods."
I forced a smile and did not answer him, aware now of a stab of panic, an uneasy sickness that could not be controlled. Gone was my glad excitement, vanished my happy pride. I was like a child brought to her first school, or a little untrained maid who has never left home before seeking a situation. Any measure of self-possession I had gained hitherto during the brief 7 weeks of marriage was like a rag now, fluttering before the wind. It seemed to me that even the most elementary knowledge of behaviour was unknown to me now. I should not know my right hand from my left, whether to stand or sit, what spoons and forks to use at dinner.
"I should shed that mackintosh," he said, glancing down at me. "It has not rained down here at all, and put your funny little fur straight. Poor lamb, I've bustled you down here like this, and you probably ought to have bought a lot of clothes in London."
"Oh, it doesn't matter to me, as long as you don't mind," I said.
"Most women think of nothing but clothes," he said absently. And turning a corner, we came to a crossroad, and the beginning of a high wall. "Here we are," he said, a new note of excitement in his voice, and I gripped the leather seat of the car with my 2 hands.
The road curved, and before us, on the left, were 2 high iron gates beside a lodge, open wide to the long drive beyond. As we drove through, I saw faces peering through the dark window of the lodge, and a child ran round from the back, staring curiously. I shrank back against the seat, my heart beating quickly, knowing why the faces were at the window and why the child stared. They wanted to see what I was like. I could imagine them now talking excitedly, laughing in the little kitchen. "Only caught sight of the top of her hat," they would say. "She wouldn't show her face. Oh, well, we'll know by tomorrow. Word will come from the house." Perhaps he guessed something of my shyness at last, for he took my hand and kissed it and laughed a little, even as he spoke.
"You mustn't mind if there's a certain amount of curiosity," he said. "Everyone will want to know what you're like. They've probably talked of nothing else for weeks. You've only got to be yourself and they will adore you. And you don't have to worry about the house. Mrs. Danvers does everything. Just leave it all to her. She'll be stiff with you at first, I dare say. She's an extraordinary character, but you mustn't let it worry you. It's just her manner. See those shrubs? It's like a blue wall along here when the hydrangeas are in bloom."
I did not answer him, for I was thinking of that self who long ago bought a picture postcard in a village shop and came out into the bright sunlight, twisting it in her hands, pleased with her purchase, thinking, this will do for my album. Manderley. What a lovely name. And now, I belonged here. This was my home. I would write letters to people saying, we shall be down at Manderley all the summer, you must come and see us. And I would walk along this drive, strange and unfamiliar to me now, with perfect knowledge, conscious of every twist and turn, marking and approving where the gardeners had worked, here a cutting back of the shrubs, there a lopping of a branch, calling at the lodge by the iron gates on some friendly errand, saying, well, how's the leg today? While the old woman, curious no longer, bade me welcome to her kitchen. I envied Maxim, careless and at ease, and the little smile on his lips which meant he was happy to be coming home. It seemed remote to me and far too distant, the time when I too should smile and be at ease, and I wished it could come quickly, that I could be old even, with grey hair and slow of step, having lived here many years. Anything but the timid, foolish creature I felt myself to be. The gates had shut to with a crash behind us. The dusty high road was out of sight, and I became aware that this was not the drive I had imagined would be Manderley's. This was not a broad and spacious thing of gravel flanked with neat turf at either side, kept smooth with rake and brush. This drive twisted and turned as a serpent, scarce wider in places than a path, and above our heads was a great colonnade of trees, whose branches nodded and intermingled with one another, making an archway for us, like the roof of a church. Even the midday sun would not penetrate the interlacing of those green leaves. They were too thickly entwined, one with another, and only little flickering patches of warm light would come in intermittent waves to dapple the drive with gold. It was very silent, very still. On the high road there had been a gay west wind blowing in my face, making the grass on the hedges dance in unison. But here there was no wind. Even the engine of the car had taken a new note, throbbing low, quieter than before. As the drive descended to the valley, so the trees came in upon us. Great beeches with lovely, smooth, white stems lifting their myriad branches to one another, and other trees, trees I could not name, coming close, so close that I could touch them with my hands. On we went, over a little bridge that spanned a narrow stream, and still this drive, that was no drive, twisted and turned like an enchanted ribbon through the dark and silent woods, penetrating even deeper to the very heart, surely, of the forest itself. And still there was no clearing, no space to hold a house. The length of it began to nag at my nerves. It must be this turn, I thought, or round that further bend. But as I leant forward in my seat, I was forever disappointed. There was no house, no field, no broad and friendly garden, nothing but the silence and deep woods. The lodge gates were a memory, and the high road something belonging to another time, another world. Suddenly I saw a clearing in the dark drive ahead, and a patch of sky, and in a moment the dark trees had thinned, the nameless shrubs had disappeared, and on either side of us was a wall of colour, blood-red, reaching far above our heads. We were amongst the rhododendrons. There was something bewildering, even shocking, about the suddenness of their discovery. The woods had not prepared me for them. They startled me with their crimson faces, massed one upon the other in incredible profusion, showing no leaf, no twig, nothing but the slaughterous red, luscious and fantastic, unlike any rhododendron plant I had seen before. I glanced at Maxim. He was smiling. "Like them?" he said. I told him yes, a little breathlessly, uncertain whether I was speaking the truth or not. For to me, a rhododendron was a homely, domestic thing, strictly conventional, mauve or pink in colour, standing one beside the other in a neat round bed. And these were monsters rearing to the sky, massed like a battalion, too beautiful, I thought, too powerful. They were not plants at all. We were not far from the house now. I saw the drive broaden to the sweep I had expected, and with the blood-red walls still flanking us on either side, we turned the last corner. And so came to Manderley,
Yes, there it was. The Mandalay I had expected. The Mandalay of my picture postcard long ago. A thing of grace and beauty, exquisite and faultless, lovelier even than I had ever dreamed, built in its hollow of smooth grassland and mossy lawns, the terraces sloping to the gardens, and the gardens to the sea. As we drove up to the wide stone steps and stopped before the open door, I saw through one of the mullioned windows that the hall was full of people, and I heard Maxim swear under his breath. "Damn that woman," he said. "She knows perfectly well I did not want this sort of thing." And he put on the brakes with a jerk. "What's the matter?" I said. "Who are all those people?"
"I'm afraid you will have to face it now," he said in irritation. "Mrs. Danvers has collected the whole damn staff in the house and on the estate to welcome us. Oh, it's all right. You won't have to say anything. I'll do it all."
I fumbled for the handle of the door, feeling slightly sick, and cold now, too, from the long drive. And as I fumbled with the catch, the butler came down the steps, followed by a footman, and he opened the door for me. He was old. He had a kind face, and I smiled up at him, holding out my hand. But I don't think he could have seen, for he took the rug instead and my small dressing case and turned to Maxim, helping me from the car at the same time.
"Well, here we are, Frith," said Maxim, taking off his gloves. "It was raining when we left London. You don't seem to have had it here. Everyone well?"
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. No, we've had a dry month on the whole. Glad to see you home, and hope you've been keeping well, and madam, too."
"Yes, we're both well, thank you, Frith. Rather tired from the drive and wanting our tea. I didn't expect this business." He jerked his head to the hall.
"Mrs. Danvers' orders, sir," said the man, his face expressionless.
"I might have guessed it," said Maxim abruptly. "Come on." He turned to me. "It won't take long. And then you shall have your tea."
We went together up the flight of steps, Frith and the footman following with the rug and my Macintosh, and I was aware of a little pain at the pit of my stomach and a nervous contraction in my throat. I can close my eyes now and look back on it and see myself as I must have been, standing on the threshold of the house, a slim, awkward figure in my stockinette dress, clutching in my sticky hands a pair of gauntlet gloves. I can see the great stone hall, the wide doors open to the library, the Peter Lelys and the Van Dykes on the walls, the exquisite staircase leading to the minstrel's gallery, and there, ranged one behind the other in the hall, overflowing to the stone passages beyond and to the dining room, a sea of faces open-mouthed and curious, gazing at me as though they were the watching crowd about the block, and I the victim with my hands behind my back. Someone advanced from the sea of faces. Someone tall and gaunt, dressed in deep black, whose prominent cheekbones and great hollow eyes gave her a skull's face, parchment white, set on a skeleton's frame. She came towards me, and I held out my hand, envying her for her dignity and her composure. But when she took my hand, hers was limp and heavy, deathly cold, and it lay in mine like a lifeless thing.
"This is Mrs. Danvers," said Maxim.
And she began to speak, still leaving that dead hand in mine, her hollow eyes never leaving my eyes, so that my own wavered and would not meet hers. And as they did so, her hand moved in mine, the life returned to it, and I was aware of a sensation of discomfort and of shame. I cannot remember her words now, but I know that she bade me welcome to Mandalay in the name of herself and the staff, a stiff, conventional speech rehearsed for the occasion, spoken in a voice as cold and lifeless as her hands had been. When she had finished, she waited as though for a reply, and I remember blushing scarlet, stammering some sort of thanks in return, and dropping both my gloves in my confusion. She stooped to pick them up, and as she handed them to me, I saw a little smile of scorn upon her lips, and I guessed at once she considered me ill-bred. Something in the expression of her face gave me a feeling of unrest, and even when she had stepped back and taken her place amongst the rest,
I could see that black figure standing out alone, individual and apart, and for all her silence, I knew her eye to be upon me. Maxim took my arm and made a little speech of thanks, perfectly easy and free from embarrassment, as though the making of it was no effort to him at all, and then he bore me off to the library to tea, closing the doors behind us, and we were alone again. Two cocker spaniels came from the fireside to greet us. They pawed at Maxim, their long silken ears strained back with affection, their noses questing his hands, and then they left him and came to me, sniffing at my heels, rather uncertain, rather suspicious. One was the mother, blind in one eye, and soon she had enough of me and took herself with a grunt to the fire again. But Jasper, the younger, put his nose into my hand and laid a chin upon my knee, his eyes deep with meaning, his tail a thump when I stroked his silken ears. I felt better when I had taken my hat off, and my wretched little fur, and thrown them both beside my gloves and my bag onto the window seat. It was a deep, comfortable room, with books lining the walls to the ceiling. The sort of room a man would move from never did he live alone. Solid chairs beside a great open fireplace, baskets for the two dogs in which I felt they never sat. But the hollows in the chairs had telltale marks. The long windows looked out upon the lawns, and beyond the lawns to the distant shimmer of the sea. There was an old, quiet smell about the room, as though the air in it was little changed for all the sweet lilac scent and the roses brought to it throughout the early summer. Whatever air came to this room, whether from the garden or from the sea, would lose its first freshness, becoming part of the unchanging room itself, one with the books, musty and never read, one with the scrolled ceiling, the dark panelling, the heavy curtains. It was an ancient, mossy smell, the smell of a silent church where services are seldom held, where rusty lichen grows upon the stones and ivy tendrils creep to the very windows. A room for peace, a room for meditation. Soon tea was brought to us, a stately little performance enacted by Frith and the young footman, in which I played no part until they had gone, and while Maxim glanced through his great pile of letters, I played with two dripping crumpets, crumbled cake with my hands, and swallowed my scalding tea. Now and again he looked up at me and smiled, and then returned to his letters. The accumulation of the last months, I supposed, and I thought how little I knew of his life here at Manderley, of how it went day by day, of the people he knew, of his friends, men and women, of what bills he paid, what orders he gave about his household. The last weeks had gone so swiftly, and I, driving by his side through France and Italy, thought only of how I loved him, seeing Venice with his eyes, echoing his words, asking no questions of the past and future, content with the little glory of the living present. For he was gayer than I had thought, more tender than I had dreamed, youthful and ardent in 100 happy ways, not the Maxim I had first met, not the stranger who sat alone at the table in the restaurant, staring before him, wrapped in his secret self. My Maxim laughed and sang, threw stones into the water, took my hand, wore no frown between his eyes, carried no burden on his shoulder. I knew him as a lover, as a friend. And during those weeks I had forgotten that he had a life, orderly, methodical, a life which must be taken up again, continued as before, making vanished weeks a brief, discarded holiday. I watched him read his letters, saw him frown at one, smile at another, dismiss the next with no expression. But for the grace of God, I thought, my letter would be lying there, written from New York, and he would read it in the same indifferent fashion, puzzled at first perhaps by the signature, and then tossing it with a yawn to the pile of others in the basket, reaching for his cup of tea. The knowledge of this chilled me. How narrow a chance had stood between me and what might have been. For he would have sat here to his tea as he sat now, continuing his home life as he would in any case, and perhaps he would not have thought of me much. Not with regret, anyway, while I, in New York, playing bridge with Mrs. Van Hopper, would wait day after day for a letter that never came. I leant back in my chair, glancing about the room, trying to instill into myself some measure of confidence, some genuine realization that I was here, at Manderley. The house of the picture postcard. The Manderley that was famous. I had to teach myself that all this was mine now, mine as much as his. The deep chair I was sitting in, that mass of books stretching to the ceiling, the pictures on the walls, the gardens, the woods, the Manderley I had read about. All of this was mine now, because I was married to Maxim. We should grow old here together. We should sit like this to our tea as old people, Maxim and I, with other dogs, the successors of these, and the library would wear the same ancient, musty smell that it did now. It would know a period of glorious shabbiness and wear when the boys were young, our boys, for I saw them sprawling on the sofa with muddy boots, bringing with them always a litter of rods and cricket bats, great clasp knives, bows and arrows. On the table there, polished now and plain, an ugly case would stand containing butterflies and moths, and another one with birds' eggs wrapped in cotton wool. "Not all this junk in here," I would say. "Take them to the schoolroom, darlings." And they would run off, shouting, calling to one another, with the little one staying behind, pottering on his own, quieter than the others. My vision was disturbed by the opening of the door, and Frith came in with the footman to clear the tea. "Mrs. Danvers wondered, madam, whether you would like to see your room," he said to me, when the tea had been taken away. Maxim glanced up from his letters. "What sort of job have they made of the East Wing?" he said. "Very nice indeed, sir, it seems to me. The men made a mess when they were working, of course, and for a time Mrs. Danvers was rather afraid it would not be finished by your return, but they cleared out last Monday. I should imagine you would be very comfortable there, sir. It's a lot lighter, of course, on that side of the house." "Have you been making alterations?" I asked. "Oh, nothing much," said Maxim briefly. "Only redecorating and painting the suite in the East Wing, which I thought we would use for hours. As Frith says, it's much more cheerful on that side of the house, and it has a lovely view of the rose garden. It was the visitors' wing when my mother was alive. I'll just finish these letters, and then I'll come up and join you. Run along and make friends with Mrs. Danvers. It's a good opportunity." I got up slowly, my old nervousness returning, and went out into the hall. I wished I could have waited for him, and then, taking his arm, seen the rooms together. I did not want to go alone with Mrs. Danvers. How vast the great hall looked, now that it was empty. My feet rang on the flagged stones, echoing to the ceiling, and I felt guilty at the sound, as one does in church, self-conscious, aware of the same constraint. My feet made a stupid pitter-patter as I walked, and I thought that Frith, with his felt soles, must have thought me foolish. "It's very big, isn't it?" I said, too brightly, too forced, a schoolgirl still, but he answered me in all solemnity. "Yes, madam, Manderley is a big place. Not so big as some, of course, but big enough. This was the old banqueting hall, in old days. It is used still on great occasions, such as a big dinner or a ball, and the public are admitted here, you know, once a week." "Yes," I said, still aware of my loud footsteps, feeling as I followed him that he considered me as he would one of the public visitors. And I behaved like a visitor too, glancing politely to right and left, taking in the weapons on the wall and the pictures, touching the carved staircase with my hands. A black figure stood waiting for me at the head of the stairs, the hollow eyes watching me intently from the white skull's face. I looked round for the solid Frith, but he had passed along the hall and into the further corridor. I was alone now with Mrs. Danvers. I went up the great stairs towards her, and she waited motionless, her hands folded before her, her eyes never leaving my face. I summoned a smile, which was not returned, nor did I blame her, for there was no purpose to the smile. It was a silly thing, bright and artificial. "I hope I haven't kept you waiting," I said. "It's for you to make your own time, madam," she answered. "I'm here to carry out your orders." And then she turned, through the archway of the gallery, to the corridor beyond. We went along a broad, carpeted passage, and then turned left through an oak door, and down a narrow flight of stairs and up a corresponding flight, and so to another door. This she flung open, standing aside to let me pass, and I came to a little anteroom or boudoir, furnished with a sofa, chairs and writing desk, which opened out to a large double bedroom with wide windows and a bathroom beyond. I went at once to the window and looked out. The rose garden lay below, and the eastern part of the terrace, while beyond the rose garden rose a smooth grass bank, stretching to the near woods. "You can't see the sea from here, then," I said, turning to Mrs. Danvers.
"No, not from this wing," she answered. "You can't even hear it, either. You would not know the sea was anywhere near from this wing."
She spoke in a peculiar way, as though something lay behind her words, and she laid an emphasis on the words, "this wing," as if suggesting that the suite where we stood now held some inferiority. "I'm sorry about that. I like the sea," I said.
She did not answer. She just went on staring at me, her hands folded before her.
"However, it's a very charming room," I said, "and I'm sure I shall be comfortable. I understand that it's been done up for our return."
"Yes," she said.
"What was it like before?" I asked.
"It had a mauve paper and different hangings. Mr. De Winter did not think it very cheerful. It was never much used, except for occasional visitors. But Mr. De Winter gave special orders in his letters that you would have this room."
"Then this was not his bedroom originally," I said.
"No, madam. He's never used the room in this wing before."
"Oh," I said. "He didn't tell me that." And I wandered to the dressing table and began combing my hair. My things were already unpacked, my brushes and comb upon the tray. I was glad Maxim had given me a set of brushes and that they were laid out there upon the dressing table for Mrs. Danvers to see. They were new, they had cost money, I need not be ashamed of them.
"Alice has unpacked for you and will look after you until your maid arrives," said Mrs. Danvers.
I smiled at her again. I put down the brush upon the dressing table. I don't have a maid," I said awkwardly. "I'm sure Alice, if she is the housemaid, will look after me all right." She wore the same expression that she had done on our first meeting when I dropped my gloves so gauchely on the floor.
"I'm afraid that would not do for very long," she said. "It's usual, you know, for ladies in your position to have a personal maid."
I flushed and reached for my brush again. There was a sting in her words I understood too well. "If you think it necessary, perhaps you would see about it for me," I said, avoiding her eyes. "Some young girl, perhaps, wanting to train."
"If you wish," she said. "It's for you to say."
There was silence between us. I wished she would go away. I wondered why she must go on standing there watching me, her hands folded on her black dress. "I suppose you have been at Manderley for many years," I said, making a fresh effort. "Longer than anyone else."
"Not so long as Frith," she said.
And I thought how lifeless her voice was, and cold, like her hand when it had lain in mine.
"Frith was here when the old gentleman was living, when Mr. De Winter was a boy."
"I see," I said.
"So you did not come till after that?"
"No,"
she said. "Not till after that."
Once more I glanced up at her, and once more I met her eyes, dark and sombre in that white face of hers, instilling into me, I knew not why, a strange feeling of disquiet, of foreboding. I tried to smile and could not. I found myself held by those eyes that had no light, no flicker of sympathy towards me.
"I came here when the first Mrs. De Winter was a bride," she said, and her voice, which had hitherto, as I said, been dull and toneless, was harsh now with unexpected animation, with life and meaning, and there was a spot of colour on the gaunt cheekbones.
The change was so sudden that I was shocked and a little scared. I did not know what to do or what to say. It was as though she had spoken words that were forbidden, words that she had hidden within herself for a long time and now would be repressed no longer. Still her eyes never left my face. They looked upon me with a curious mixture of pity and of scorn, until I felt myself to be even younger and more untutored to the ways of life than I had believed. I could see she despised me, marking with all the snobbery of her class that I was no great lady, that I was humble, shy, and diffident. Yet there was something besides scorn in those eyes of hers. Something surely of positive dislike or actual malice. I had to say something. I could not go on sitting there playing with my hairbrush, letting her see how much I feared and mistrusted her. "Mrs. Danvers," I heard myself saying, "I hope we shall be friends and come to understand one another. You must have patience.